You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
Thursday, 22 May, local building permit data due 1 p.m. this afternoon. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from the MoneyWeb Global Headquarters in Johannesburg, South Africa. On the show today, I want to chat NASPASS and process. Still a viable option for Chinese exposure. That discount to NAV is big, but maybe it's just more the corporate actions, the listings of some assets, buying of others. Then we've got Justin Brophy from Enbro Capital Investment, their new Titans ETN listing on the J. And Andrew Moyles, New World Wealth, their recent USA Wealth Report 2025, staggering numbers. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more global opportunities through their partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management. Morning headlines, MoneyWeb. Southern Sun occupancy levels exceed 60% for the first time since 2019, and that with challenges in both Durban and, more notably, Maputo. Business Day, SA delegation to US presents united front against Trump ambush. South Africa's White House delegation has pushed back against white genocide claims by President Trump and presented plans for a trade deal. Morning markets, US was red, S&P down 1.6%, NASDAQ off 1.3%, and the 10-year is at 4.598%. East mostly red, Sydney up 0.5%, Tokyo down 0.9%, Hong Kong off 0.4%, and Tencent 0.75% lower. Commodities mostly green, gold futures 3,370. Brent is red at 64.92. Platinum is 1,084. Palladium 1,038. The rand is 17.98. Bitcoin 111,300, a new all-time high. And top 40 opening call 250 points or 0.3% to the red.
MoneyWeb now on the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting now with Lonwabo Mnakabela. He's a Perpetua Investment Manager. Lonwabo, appreciate the early morning time. I've been pondering the last few days around NASPASS, around process. The discounts to NAV remain massive. I mean, I think the process, the NASPASS NAV is like 8,600, price is 5,200. I'm not sure that's going to necessarily close. But we are seeing sort of deals happening. We've got the Just Eat takeaway. Process did a deal in Latin America with an online travel agency, listing some businesses. The new CEO is shaking things up. And my question then, I suppose, is this still a good investment for local investors to get exposure to China, but also more than that, the internet economy?
Hi, good morning, Simon. Great to chat to you again. Yeah, and I think it's a good question. I think, you know, South African investors don't really have a lot of options in terms of getting exposure to, you know, to the technology sector, and particularly in Asia. For that reason, it does actually then stand out as something that's, you know, worth taking a deep look into. I mean, the discounts, do, you're right, they still remain quite massive. I think I worked out that discount equates to about a trillion rand. You know, and in Process's case, it's, you know, the share price would be worth 1,400 versus the sub 1,000 today. And they are buying back shares. And, you know, to date, they've spent about $35 billion buying back a quarter of the shares in issue. So that's, you know, they often have a slide that shows that that's the largest buyback program globally, you know, for a company in that sector. But what it does mean is that every time they buy back a dollar worth of assets, they pay 65 cents and get a dollar worth of assets. And so that very action kind of increases the per share value of the company. And that alone actually allows it to grow. And then I'd say, I mean, Tencent reported the other day, and now, you know, and you saw they reported 22% EBIT growth. You know, so the business is still growing and is trading on a 18 multiple now. You know, earlier on in the decade, or maybe a decade ago, it was probably trading on 35 times then. So it's derated substantially, and it's a business that's still growing at those 20% plus. And Tencent actually accounts for 80% of Prosus's NAV. So it's still quite substantial. But that 35% discount does mean you actually get to buy Tencent on a 12 multiple, which I think by any measure is attractive. Now, the criticism in the past was that, oh, but they're going to, waste money on the ramp and loss making and so on. And your earlier question is quite right. I mean, the biggest cultural change you've seen in Tencent is how they approach the ramp. They've been much more circumspect on what they buy, how much they pay, and how are they going to unlock value. You've seen the ramp go from making losses. It turned $400 million EBIT positive, and they're targeting another doubling of that in the current year. And then obviously they've also been making these acquisitions. I think probably the big shift is that the current CEO, with his experience at iFood and how to unlock and how to grow an online business, will really give them some ability to then grow both Just Eat and possibly integrate it within the portfolio, and then the online travel business as well in LATAM, which is a large market and that's growing. So the CEO is incentivized to get this right. I think it's about $100 million payday if he can get that market cap to $164 billion. It's currently $120 today. Tencent alone could probably get them there. But, I think to the earlier comments, they're taking substantial steps, to unlock the value from the rest.
No, I take your point. And it is, I suppose, in many senses, they really have, the CEOs, not on notice, but they've said this is how you're going to earn the big bucks in many ways. And it's my sense is it's a lot more than just Tencent, which is what it used to be. There's a lot more coming through, as you say, that LATAM is going to be important, Just Eat takeaway, and they're listing stuff. There's stuff happening here. And maybe at some point that the discount to NAV will start to narrow. We'll leave it there, Lon Robin Lacabella. Perpetua Investment Managers, appreciate the early morning time. And that's our poll today, LinkedIn and Twitter. Are you holding these tech giants? I mean, they are tech giants on our JSE. As Nwabo said, they're also not expensive. Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn and Twitter. Let your money weather the storms with Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in the Stanlib Global Select Fund, a diversified all-weather equity portfolio submanaged by JP Morgan Asset Management.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
I'm chatting with Justin Brophy. He's CEO at Anbro Capital Investments, a new Titans ETN listed on the JSE. Was it last week, the week before? Justin, appreciate the time. You've done a couple of tricks here. The first is that you've distilled down to sort of 11 sectors that you're looking to invest into. How did you get those 11 sectors from what must be, I don't know, dozens, maybe hundreds in the US markets?
So good morning, Simon, and good morning to all your listeners. Great question. Excited to launch our Titans. Share code is TRTANS on the stock exchange, and obviously ANGGFA for the unit trust. Getting to your question, there are 11 what are called GICS sectors. These stand for Global Industry Classification Standard sectors. And these are the usual suspects in the US. These are info technology, communication sector, consumer discretionary, utilities, financials, healthcare. It's breaking down the US sort of S&P 500 into all its individual sectors. And so that's what we've done. We've looked for the biggest and best across all of these individual GICS sectors.
And that's what you've done. Having got those 11 sectors, you've basically gone and said, what's the best stock in each sector? And then you get that stock. So this is, if I understand correctly, a 11 stock fund.
Close. It's an 11 sector fund, and what we look at is the best five or six stocks in each sector, and then we equally weight those in each sector.
Mm-hmm. And you've obviously, I mean, you're not just doing a simple market cap here, or are you? Is it some sort of bespoke methodology as to which are those best?
Yes, absolutely. Our proprietary model searches for the companies within a very strict framework, and we obviously look for across those 11 sectors, we look at financial stability, profitability, liquidity, beta to the market, mm-hmm. historical management performance, and a lot of proprietary in-house sort of screens that we use to get to those top five or six in each sector.
And then I suppose over time they will change, but probably not often. I mean, you know, some of these stocks are, for example, you know, NextEra Energy, Berkshire Hathaway, Apple, Amazon, they're not going to in a hurry lose their shine.
Absolutely. So this portfolio only has an annual rebalance. Mm-hmm. That is the planned annual rebalance. However, if there was anything to happen, if any of these huge companies got bought out or there was a merger or anything major happened, think United Healthcare recently what happened, we would then look at that portfolio and the next sort of candidate would come in across an equal weighting, but that's highly unlikely.
Okay, so they are equal weight and then you're re-weighting on an annual basis as well.
That's correct.
How has performance been? It's a new fund, but you've probably done some back testing. I like the thinking behind it. How has it sort of done in tests relative to an S&P or the like?
So look, the portfolio in two phases. The unit trust obviously back tested. Mm-hmm. The portfolio has lived at Anbro for the last 11 and has been used as our core portfolio. Mm-hmm. In terms of performance over 10 years, we've performed at around 520% versus the S&P 500, which has done 209. 5 years, we've done 23.7 annualized versus S&P at 14.5 annualized. And 3 year, we've done 20.5 annualized versus 13.1% annualized on the S&P 500.
I like your phrase there. You're calling it a core portfolio. A lot of folks, myself included, will often think sort of at the core of a portfolio, I might want a nice global diverse ETF or something. And they certainly have their place. But this perhaps is a better situation for a core. It is a concentration of stocks. It's best of best. It is US listed. But of course, these are global companies. Apple sitting in front of a Mecca right now. This is very much a core portfolio construct.
Absolutely. And I think the best part about this is it's a fire and forget. Mm-hmm. If you're looking for a global exposure, you've got the biggest and best equally weighted, which is important because you don't want that Mag 7 pulling you up and dragging you down. What you want is an equally weighted core that's going to be there with the best according to sector for the investor.
And it does mean, in some sense, I suppose, you miss some of the hot fads. But on the flip side, you kind of also miss the hot fads as they fade away. And these are all, you know, global names. These are companies. I mean, some of them. Amazon is relatively new. It's now some almost 30 years old. But these are not fads, which, again, is why it fits well in the core of a portfolio.
Absolutely. I mean, just quickly, if one thinks of a three-year return over the last 3 years to May, and I said to you, Microsoft or Costco, who would have performed better? And the reality is Costco has performed. They've performed better at 119% versus 85%. Vistra in the utility space or Meta? Vistra's done 405% versus Meta 220 to 236. So I think a lot of those guys, when you market weight, you miss the value they bring to the portfolio, those more defensives. So it does have an ability to be more defensive. Illustrated in the last 3 months, where we've seen the impact of tariffs, where this portfolio is only down 4.1% versus the S&P off at stages at 11.5%, Simon.
I like that idea, the market weight. There's a flip side to it, is in your S&P 500, you've probably got about, I don't know, 450 stocks that are literally, you know, collectively a couple of percentage points, and frankly, aren't going to do anything for your portfolio anyway.
Correct. 30 to 35% of that index is the Mag 7 and the top 10. So you really are, if you throw in Eli Lilly and Berkshire Hathaway, you know, those are your real 30 to 35% drivers in the S&P 500.
We'll leave it there. That's Justin Brophy. He's CEO, Anbro Capital Investments, Titans ETN, and the Titans Unit Trust. Justin, appreciate the time. Let your money benefit from experience with StanLib Asset Management. Find out about StanLib Global Select Fund, which follows an investment discipline that has delivered results for three decades.
MoneyWeb now, on the money.
I'm chatting with Andrea Moyles, the New World Wealth. They got a recent U.S. Wealth Report 2025 in conjunction with Henley and Partners. Andrea, appreciate the time. No surprises that reading this report is staggering in terms of the numbers. The U.S., what, 6 million millionaires, 10,800 centimillionaires, over 850 billionaires. I suppose it tells us what we kind of knew is that the money's in America to a fair degree, and so are the millionaires and the billionaires.
Absolutely. America now accounts for 37% of the world's millionaires with liquid wealth of over 1 million US dollars and around 33% of the billionaires. So it's actually more dominant among the run-of-the-mill millionaires than it is actually among the billionaires.
And growth has been phenomenal. In the report, you mentioned that from 2014 to 2024, millionaire population up 78%. To put it in perspective, China was up 74%, but China was very much more a sort of booming economy, 5, 6, 7, 8% GDP growth. America manages this as the world's largest economy, but it is a staggering number.
Absolutely. I mean, China was growing very quickly up until around 2017, 2018. Mm-hmm. And then since then, the growth's been a lot slower. Then obviously, we've been looking at that decade from about 2014 till the end of 2024, so a few months back. And at that period, the US, towards the end of that period, post-COVID, the US did a lot better than China. And as a result, over the decade, it actually millionaire numbers actually went up faster in the US. The US was one of the, I think last time I checked, it was one of the five fastest growing millionaire markets in the world over the last decade. The only markets that grew quicker were a couple of small markets like Montenegro, Malta, Poland, just a few of those. But apart from them, the US was actually top performer.
And geographically, New York City, the wealthiest in the US in terms of millionaires, centimillionaires, and billionaires. Bay Area following up, again, that makes some sense. That's Silicon Valley, San Francisco. Interestingly, Bay Area manages to actually have more billionaires. And I suppose that is the tech story to a fair degree.
Yes. So the Bay Area, I mean, some people say we shouldn't bunch the Bay Area all together because it's obviously Silicon Valley has a number of cities. So some people say it's a bit unfair to compare it to New York City. But in terms of total population, it's actually got a lower total population than New York City. So it's not actually that unfair a comparison. Yeah, it is quickly catching up with New York City. One thing with New York City is there are obviously a lot of commuter towns like Greenwich, you know, Darien and places on Long Island that we're not including in New York City. So yeah, it is always tricky to compare those two places in particular, but they are the dominant wealth hubs, especially when it comes to the top end, the centimillionaires and the billionaires. They're very dominant, those two areas.
The fastest growing areas, Scottsdale, I have to say, I never really heard of Scottsdale, West Palm Beach, and I suppose it makes sense. These are the up-and-comers. They're going to be geographic places we're perhaps a little less familiar with, and they've seen the fastest growth in terms of wealth.
Well, Scottsdale's an interesting story because it's obviously in the greater Phoenix metro, and it's a bit like the Sandton story in a way, where Sandton, all the wealth in Johannesburg has kind of ended up in Sandton. A lot of the top-end wealth in the greater Phoenix metro has ended up in the Scottsdale Paradise Valley area. It's similar in a way to Sandton in that people have gravitated to that area. So because of that, it's basically all the big tech companies in Greater Phoenix, most of the top execs and the founders of those companies, they live in Scottsdale. Also, it's one of the top lifestyle and golf estate hubs in the world. A lot of the really expensive golf estates are based in Scottsdale, and they have been for many years. It's got kind of a combination of desert and mountain scenery that I think is quite appealing in those big cactuses. So it's been popular for a long time, also as a retirement destination for people from California. It's slightly lower taxes than California. And a lot of big tech companies are actually saying they're going to enlarge their presence in Greater Phoenix, which will obviously boost Scottsdale. And that's why it is the top performer. And then West Palm Beach, you mentioned, obviously, a lot of wealthy people have moved there from the East Coast, especially.
Yeah, absolutely. In 2024, the U.S. recorded net gain about 3,800 high net worth individuals. There are still people moving into the U.S. and rich people at that, 10 billionaires. But Henley & Partners data also shows a significant increase in inquiries from U.S. nationals for alternative residence and citizen options abroad, which I suppose it's kind of keeping the options open, but also maybe it's just ease of travel. But it did surprise me, the number of people looking for alternative citizen options.
Yes, well, I think a lot of countries have become a little bit more difficult around how long people can stay there if they have second homes in those countries and places like Europe, and they've kind of forced people into a situation where they often have to pay a bit of money to get that second residency. I think that's probably what that's about. I mean, leaving the US is not an easy thing, especially if you're a US passport holder. If you're just a green card holder, then you can give in your green card, but you're still liable for US tax. So if you look at the billionaire list, for instance, that Forbes compile, we also do a billionaire list. Very few or any of the US-born billionaires ever leave the US. Whereas if you look at a place like the UK, most of the really well-known UK billionaires don't live in the UK anymore. And South Africa is sort of a mix.
Yeah.
There are quite a lot of billionaires that have left, although some of them weren't billionaires when they did leave. But if you actually look at all the US-born billionaires, like 99% of them still live in the US.
That's actually a great point. It's more about perhaps ease of travel more than anything else. We leave it there. It's Andrea Mills, New World Wealth, the USA Wealth Report 2025 with Henley & Partners. Appreciate the time. That's it for today. I was chatting with Jimmy Miraha yesterday around the Sasol Capital Markets Day that the market responded very positively to. We asked you, is it time to hold Sasol? Almost half said holding and loving. Third said, nope, not for you. The rest said, maybe in time. Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn and Twitter. We're having a birthday breakfast for the show next Friday in Rosebank, Johannesburg. If you want to come along, email studio@moneyweb.co.za answering the question, how many years has this show been running? This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more certainty to navigate volatile market conditions. We're live every weekday morning, the MoneyWeb website and the app, 6:30 a.m. podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie, Nobokle, Nicole, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again tomorrow. Spear results.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.